The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra presents Masterworks 4, Bliss, featuring Sonia Bosca Harrison, Saturday, March 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, March 16th at 2 p.m. at NDSU's Festival Concert Hall. Tickets at fmsymphony.org.
Welcome to Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We hope you had a great weekend. Coming up a little bit later on today's show, North Dakota has a state climatologist, and his name is Daryl Richardson. He sat down with Prairie Public's CEO, John Harris, to talk about what we all like to argue about. That's the weather. We'll air an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show.
And we begin Main Street today with Pulitzer Prize finalist author Karen Russell, whose new book is The Antidote, a surreal and haunting novel set against the backdrop of the Dust Bowl, blending historical fiction with elements of the supernatural. Karen, welcome to Main Street.
Hi, Craig. Thanks for having me.
We are pleased that you are with us, Karen. Your stories seem to have a way of making the surreal feel deeply human, and I'm referring to maybe a lifetime ago for you, the alligator wrestling swamps of Swamplandia, to the memory vaults of The Antidote, which we'll talk more about today. But Karen, when did you first realize that storytelling wasn't just something you love, but something you could build a life around?
You know, I mean, I was a reader first, like many writers, and I really needed books like breathing air. So I think my kids now are, I have a second grade son who's always scribbling in his notebook. I was that way too. It was like, as soon as you could stack words into sense, right? I mean, I think we are just storytellers. It's like the kind of animal we are. It's how we make sense of our world and our lives. But I didn't know that you could make a living doing that, right? So I really thought I would be a journalist. I went to Northwestern because they have a wonderful journalism program. And then it was sort of like as irrational as love, you know? I defected, I think, to my, you know, to the concern of some of my loved ones, because creative writing, you know, my dad said when I told him I wanted to go to Columbia and get a master's in fine arts and creative writing, he said, so you're going to get a graduate degree in lying? You know, I think it was, you know, and part of it is that it is like, it's not, I don't know anyone who does it because they are in it for like the Hollywood megabucks, you know, it's like, it operates like love. And the writers who I admire and emulate, you know, they set me up. The reason I write the way I do is because I read like such an omnivore as a very young person, I think.
I read where you used reading as an antidote against the rest of the world when you were young.
Yeah. You know, our family had some hard times, and I think books were a place where I felt such a safe intimacy, right? You can bring all of yourself to a book in the same way that you can bring all of yourself to the natural world, right? There's no dissembling. You have a kind of spaciousness outside of ordinary time to think and feel things and know things that I think are difficult to think and feel, know, right? Like in this kind of lighting, when you're Craig and I'm Karen Russell and we're, you know, performing ourselves a little bit. I loved that kind of, you could have this secret life a little bit away from your everyday. And it was sort of both an escape and a confrontation, right? A way to, I've heard people say sometimes, oh, fantasy is my escape. I always think it's a little bit of both, right? It's like you disarm a certain kind of stakes. You're like, oh, it's just fiction. And now you can actually, you know, move into some dangerous territory. And, you know, there are places that I've gone in my writing that I don't think my waking mind would really let me go, right? Or I don't think it's even possible to talk about, you know, on air or anywhere. So I love books for that.
I've thought of this in the context of watching my grandchildren grow up now, as old as sixth grade and younger than that. And I wonder if kids today can still use reading as that antidote with that thing they have in their other hand called a phone. And I'm worried about that.
I am very worried about that too. And just what it's doing to all of our attention spans. My friend who's a musician said songs are now like 30 seconds shorter on average than they were like a decade ago. I mean, you can track it, what's happening, right? I worry that with my kids too. And we read The Secret Garden. this is a book where the suspense is all about like plants bursting through the soil. So it was such a different pace than a lot of their media where it's like CGI generated like explosions and just a laugh a minute. And but they loved it. But it was a struggle too. You know, I don't think that that pacing is so familiar to them.
Let's talk about your new book, The Antidote. In my mind, Karen, it's kind of a novel about survival, land of memory and identity. And you bring the Dust Bowl to life with this eerie beauty. You blend history with the supernatural. What drew you into this moment in American history, the Dust Bowl? And what did it allow you to explore about the ways we remember, we forget, and we endure?
Thank you so much, Craig, for that question. My friend Morgan Talty, was generously read this, and he told me, wow, memory is both the poison and the cure here. And I thought that was a really succinct way to kind of feel into what the book seemed to want to be about. This region of the world, you know, it's not, I don't have family ties to it, but it really captured my imagination as an early reader of The Grapes of Wrath. This story of, you know, an economic collapse and an ecological collapse felt resonant with, you know, some of what we're all living today, right? So kind of exploring those connections felt important. But I got this idea early on when I was finishing my first novel. I had this image of a woman holding an ear horn, those antique hearing aids, and someone was whispering something into it. And I was like, oh, it's leaving their mind and it's going into her. She's like a memory bank. She makes her living taking deposits from people of the things that they really can't stand to remember, but they can't bear to forget them either, right? And that part felt almost universal to me, like certainly in my own life, I'm sure in yours. They're pages of your life story you would tear out and put on a shelf, just temporarily maybe, right? But things that it's like, not even just horrible things, right? But maybe something that's so overwhelmingly blissful, or, you know, something precious, you don't want it to fade via daily reminiscence, right? So she has a bunch of customers in this town, and for many years now, she's been receiving deposits from them. So she knows the secret. She doesn't know it, like it sort of just sinks under the waterline of her consciousness. That part of the story felt important to me. So she feels their weight without really understanding what these secrets are. And during Black Sunday, they're whisked from her body. She wakes up, she says bankrupt, they're all gone. She remembers her own biography and nothing else. She feels the weight of all of these secrets she held has vanished. And she and this feral orphan start counterfeiting memories for people, and it goes very poorly. And so I think fiction can do well that you can't really study, right, in other ways. Historians and sociologists, there's no way to study these invisible omissions or the way that deceit and self-deceit kind of go hand in hand, or the way that in your own family, maybe some stories get passed down, some don't. And it's hard to feel in aggregate how something so private and individual can become something like a mass denial or a mass forgetting, right? And I thought a lot about this. I think the story of our history, you know, I learned it in a very partitioned way that did have lots of holes. And so maybe part of the project of this book for me felt too like having a longer timeline and a wider focus for the stories we tell about the Dust Bowl and what caused it.
So I've asked you to set us up by maybe reading a little bit of Black Sunday. Can you do that for us?
Absolutely. On Black Sunday, before anybody knew to call it Black Sunday, I woke up in the jailhouse to a sound like a freight train tunneling through me, an ear-splitting howl that seemed to shake the stone walls. My body trembled like a husk on the cot, my fingers clawed into the mattress. For those early moments in the dark, I was nothing but the fear of floating off. What had happened to me while I slept? It felt as if a knife had scraped the marrow from my bones. Something vital inside me had liquefied and drained away, and in its place was this new weightlessness, lightness, and wrongness, a blanketing whiteness that ran up my spine and seeped out of my mouth. Bankrupt was the word that rose in my mind.
This idea that memory is something that can be physically transferred or safeguarded. How'd you come up with that?
I mean, part of it, I'm sure, is just as a writer, that does feel sort of like what we're doing, right? I feel like I'm always, you know, trying to give people something with the texture of a memory from a life that they haven't lived, right? And you're importing it into your own body. I mean, you know, the great book exchange feels like that to me. But I think also it's the way that kids think about narrative, right? Kind of taking these things that feel so abstract and fast moving and literalizing them, or finding a way to, you know, allegorize that transfer, which is so spooky. I was thinking too, you know, a lot of what stands in for my memory of this time that I never lived are the photographs the New Deal photographers made. So Dorothea Lange, Walker Evans, Gordon Parks, these incredible photographs. And then as I was researching, I learned there are also a lot of hole punch negatives that are part of this file, sort of another shadow archive, that the things that weren't printed, weren't published, were rejected. And so I thought a little bit too about how privately and collectively what we call memory is edited, you know, what, you know, certain things are selected and made public and disseminated, and other things we may never see. And other things are hard, you know, I think for all of us to really reckon with individually too.
What do you think Dell looks like?
Oh my gosh.
This is the protagonist in the book.
You know, it's so funny. There's a writer I love, Linda Barry, who calls one of her characters Pug Ugly. I don't think Dell is quite that, but she's not conventionally beautiful, you know? She's kind of like, she's short and stocky and a scrapper. She's very angry. Her mother is one of several murdered women in this region. And, you know, there's a young man who has been accused of being a serial, a mass murderer. She's skeptical about all of it. And but as for her physical appearance, yeah, I think that she's certainly a lot more muscular than I am. I mean, my sport was cross country. I just like ran away from even my teammates.
We're enjoying our conversation with Karen Russell. She's written the book, The Antidote. It's a surreal and haunting novel set against the backdrop of the Dust Bowl. As the novel unfolds, you have other perspectives too. We have Dell's uncle, Harp. We have the sheriff. How do you decide which characters, when you're writing, deserve a voice, Karen, when you attack the overall theme of the book?
That's also a great question. It's a polyphonic novel, so there's several different point of view characters, including a little deeper in a cat who kind of sauntered back into the novel, who says some things I think the human characters can't actually. So that's one way is like, you know, how do I tell an honest story, and who can, which point of view is going to give us which truth, I guess, or shine, you know, illuminate something that feels true. So I think that they all work in concert together, and they start out as true strangers. A lot is happening in this book, but a lot is happening in each of their lives. It's set during this 2-month period between the Black Sunday duster and the flooding of the Republican River. And so those are the kind of extreme weather events that bookend this time where, you know, after Black Sunday, each of them is experiencing something mysterious and vexing. And they become united maybe in one mystery and kind of one quest for justice. And so I just thought each of these characters, they each have their own particular gift. And it really takes all of them to make anything happen.
It's also kind of a magical feeling, and it made me think of poetry. Do you enjoy poetry? I think I've read where initially you didn't.
Initially, I didn't. That's true. Because it was taught to me as like this riddle that I was like too stupid to solve. You know, it was like taught in this way where they were like, all right, find the theme. You have 40 minutes. Right. And so, you know, I had the reaction, I think some, you know, that where it's just sort of like, well, why don't you just tell me? I didn't understand really. Right. That there's if you could just paraphrase one meaning out, what would be the point of the poem?
Your novels would just be a page then, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's the funny thing about interviews too. I mean, I do my best, but I do sort of think the novel expresses something that if I could just say, you know, people will say, what's it about? And I feel like, God, if I could tell you that, why would I be a novelist? Like,
here's a 2-sentence summary.
Right. I'm really bad always at the elevator pitch, but I think part of the reason why is it just feels deeply experiential. Like it feels like making a world for people. And a lot of the truth that I'm getting at, perversely, I think it really resists easy articulation. Like it isn't something that I know how to, you know, here's the photograph and here's the caption, right? And I think there are different ways into and through this book for different kinds of readers. I mean, I felt sort of by design, I really hope there are sort of, it, you know, how you have a prism and it refracts light a little differently depending on what facet you're looking at.
You told us you're a cross-country runner, or you were at one time in your life, but not a basketball player. yet basketball kind of plays a significant role in the story here. How did you decide to incorporate it?
You know, I had already made the decision that this feral orphan was going to be part of a basketball team. I think because, you know, when I was a younger person, my best friend is part of the inspiration for Dell. I don't know, Alexis, if you're listening, you're much more attractive than the Dell that I just described. But she was a basketball star. She was incredible. I was more of like an easy layup hope, you know.
If it's any consolation, I was the worst basketball player in my class. And I wear that with pride.
Oh, Craig, what's like the opposite of a power forward? I was like a wilting flower forward.
Here's your rebound. Go for it.
Right. No, totally. I was like, after you. Yeah. But I, you know, the idea of being on a team felt important to me in different ways. This book is about sort of loners and outcasts and misfits who find... Yeah, it's on that team, you know, these are young people who the reason they're able to play basketball during this terrible period is they're either not needed at home or there's not vigilance at home or there's some reason why they're making this found family. I thought the story in different ways, you know, the characters that I just mentioned, they also come together in a kind of chosen family. I was thinking about that just today, that my first book is really about a biological family. And this one is more about the families that we make. But not because I was a great basketball star. I just sort of like, they're different echoes in different sections. And for Dell, it's sort of like she's the leader of this team. And she takes on this almost Captain Ahab-like monomaniacal quality. Like she wants to win so badly, it puts the whole team in jeopardy. And there are other moments in this story where you can sort of see those blinders, right? The zones of oblivion that we all wander into in our single-minded pursuit of our own goal.
Karen, I think you ask readers to consider why we choose to remember. If there's one question you hope readers sit with maybe after finishing The Antidote, what would it be?
Oh, if I have to pick just one, I think what choices do we have is a good one, because at different points in this book, the characters feel one of the refrains in all of their sections is better you than me. They each have this moment where, you know, they resist acting because they are afraid of punishment or afraid of some consequence. They're watching things happen to other characters and they're not able or willing to step up. And I was thinking a lot about how often in my own life, you know, it's like, what choice do I have gets intoned as a self-justification or a wail of despair instead of a genuine question. So maybe it's saying, yeah, what choices do we have, right? Like, does it feel good to live the way we do? And what choices do we have? Like, what changes can we make to make a more vibrant future plausible?
Karen, you've written some celebrated short stories in your life. In the previous novel, we mentioned briefly Swamplandia. How was writing The Antidote different from your other works? And did anything surprise you about the process this time along?
Oh my God, Craig, everything surprised me. It was a very different process, actually. You know, my research for Swamplandia was just being like a kid in South Florida, which, like, I'm not discounting how grueling some of that research process was. But I read books. You know, I read books. But for this novel, I really needed help. So I went out to Nebraska on a few different research trips, different parts of the state. And I cold called some people. You know, I was reading their work and I realized, wow, I really need help both to understand this history and also to imagine some of the book. There's a character whose camera kind of can see across the plains of time and seems to be able to draw into focus things that haven't happened yet, but might. And so I actually really needed help to imagine a beautiful future. I'm very good at imagining a dystopia. And and that was a different kind of research to try to pool visions and expertise. And, you know, I talked to kind of historians and activists. I talked to some people with the Pawnee Seed Preservation Project, which is an alliance between Nebraskan farmers and farmers in the Pawnee Nation. They're growing Pawnee corn on those homelands again. So I talked to someone here, Mimi Castillo, who taught me a lot about soil and the promise of regenerative agriculture. you know, for storing carbon and water in the ground. Like, she really feels that moving from conventional agriculture to regenerative agriculture is like the best tool we have to mitigate the worst effects of climate change. So, you know, I guess I just really sought out some different inputs to my own, you know, stunted imagination and different perspectives on this history, right? Like, I heard from people who were homesteaders, the descendants of homesteaders in Nebraska, and also the descendants of, you know, Native people who were forced to leave their homes to small reservations in Oklahoma, which, you know, as you know, is the epicenter really of the Dust Bowl.
Let me ask you this personal question, Karen. You've written so well. You've received both a MacArthur and a Guggenheim Fellowship. You were a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Where does the antidote fit in the larger arc of your career?
I mean, I feel like I'm still like a little too eye level to know quite yet what I can barely believe that it's like a book that you read, Craig. I mean, I gestated this story for a really long time. So it's honestly shocking to me that other readers even know these characters still, you know, and a great joy. I think that it feels like a bookend to Swamplandia. A lot. I wrote several story collections and a novella in those intervening years, all of which I think in retrospect are testing grounds for different parts of this. You know, some of the same questions occur in them. Some are set in Nebraska. So it feels like they feel very connected and almost like bookends. And I think this is a new chapter for me as a writer. I'm not, in a good way, I'm not sure right now what kind of writer I'll become.
You have a second grader. You have family responsibilities.
I do. I have a second grader, beautiful.
So what's next?
Well, I mean, they're always telling me, they think that I should have included their artwork in this novel. I think they were a little disappointed. and they are. They're always saying, why don't you collaborate with us? So you never know. Maybe there'll be like some really terrifying bedtime stories coming your way.
What's the scope of how you plan what's in your future, Karen? I mean, this was a heavy lift.
Right.
Yeah, a heavy lift.
You're going to spend some time promoting it, but you have to have thought about what's next.
Well, yeah, for sure. I have a story collection that's already sold to my wonderful editor at Knopf. And the working title is How Does It End? Which is a question that I think we're all haunted by. About half of it is I think the stories are finished and published, and now I'm sort of back in story land, and it's interesting. It sort of feels like playing the accordion or something. I had this novel that felt so expansive, and now I think I'm trying to remember how to work in the snow globe universe of a short story.
Give me an idea of your day of writing. How do you organize yourself as we kind of wrap things up here on Main Street?
Do you ever go to your GP, your doctor, and they ask you like what your week looks like, and like you lie a little bit? You know, like I always do. I'm like, I exercise 3 times a week, moderate alcohol consume, like all of it, you know? My ideal day writing is I send my kids to school and then I write for 4 hours. I can't usually write well longer than that. If I'm really hot on something, then it's like all I wanna do. And then, you know, I teach too. I have other kind of side gigs. But those morning hours are really precious. And then, and then I get to get my kids from school, which is a joy of being a self-employed, you know, lady who takes dictation from ghosts for a living.
My guest has been Karen Russell. Her new book is The Antidote, a surreal and haunting novel set against the backdrop of the Dust Bowl. I will attest it's a great read. Karen, it's been a pleasure having you with us today on Main Street.
Thank you so much, Craig. It was a pleasure.
Coming after the break, we'll hear a conversation between Prairie Public's CEO John Harris and Daryl Richardson. He's a state climatologist here in North Dakota. He'll talk about his role, climate change, and naturally, the weather. That's coming up right after this. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. North Dakota has a state climatologist. His name is Daryl Richardson. And let's be honest, there's one job where people always want to hear your predictions and then argue about them. It's this one. He sat down with Prairie Public CEO John Harris to talk about his role, climate change, and naturally, the weather. Because what's a North Dakota conversation without that?
Our guest joining us now is Daryl Richardson, the North Dakota State climatologist, and of course also director of North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network. Daryl, thanks for joining us today.
It is a pleasure to be here.
Well, as we get started, before you tell us about all your jobs, tell us about yourself and your background.
I grew up in a very small town in southern Minnesota, between the cities of Mankato and Faribault, which hopefully most people would recognize in southern Minnesota, a little town called Elysian. When I grew up, it was only 350. It's grown quite a bit because people discovered our two lakes in town, and so there's a lot of lake homes there. But I went to what's now referenced as Minnesota State University, Mankato State, you know, when I went there. Much of my career was in broadcast meteorology. Worked in a small station in Mankato, Minnesota, down in Sioux Falls, and here in Fargo and Grand Forks at WDAY and WDAZ. And now for almost the last 11 years, I've been working up at NDSU, most of that time as the director of the North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network. But now for almost a year now, I've been also serving as the state climatologist for North Dakota.
We're going to touch on both, but let's start off with what exactly the state climatologist, what is it and what are your duties there?
You know, you can take on a number of different roles in that position where you want to go. You know, I really been focusing on the integrity of our data in North Dakota, trying to reorganize it, put it back together. There's so much to learn from what has happened in the past. And so to get that data, and there's so many just basic data requests that I do every single day. You know, someone is asking for certain data. Say the tragic fires in Western North Dakota last year, the presidential declaration for that, I was asked, which is oftentimes the case in these scenarios, can you write up the weather summary, you know, what actually happened? Because being the state climatologist gives that report a little bit more, I don't know, notoriety. Perhaps. So we work in that issue. A lot of training for different things, a lot of public talks that we do for that, keeping a track of the records. It really goes on and on, but you could also, you know, take it into different realms. I serve two positions, so I really try to focus on, you know, the past climate, working with the climate data that we have, the reports that are necessary for that, and a lot of the data requests that we have, really, again, on a daily basis.
Take us back for a moment, and when did you become fascinated with the weather?
Probably when I was, I don't know my exact age, but it was probably around 4 or 5. And it was really a lot of people that are interested in weather. Always sometimes comes down to thunderstorms, especially when you grow up in the Midwest. And when I was really young, I remember asking my brother, what causes thunder? And he told me two clouds bump against each other. Well, you have to remember, he was only like 8 or 9 years old at that time. And I thought I saw a couple clouds bump together, and I did not get any thunder. So it's joys of our generation being a little older. We had a bookmobile as our library that came into town, and it was always exciting when the bookmobile came in. So I looked up a book about weather and found out it was lightning that causes thunder. But I've been fascinated with it my entire life, and I've also always been fascinated with climate and climate studies and the past weather. And so I just have the best job in the world for me. I pinch myself at times that I get to do this for a living.
You know, what did you learn with a meteorology degree, and how did that prepare you for all the positions you had?
Probably that the constant reminder that the atmosphere is a chaotic, nonlinear system, and it really can't be forecasted. And we do a pretty good job at it, but it, you know, the weather and being a forecaster, and which I still do, just not as much as I used to in that part of my world, always is very humbling. And you know, it's really hard to be too arrogant when you're a meteorologist, because Mother Nature will always teach you a lesson and throw that we still don't completely understand what's going on.
And as far as state climatologist, was that position created or did you succeed someone?
I had was successor. Sadly, our former state climatologist passed away from cancer about a year ago. And so they ended up asking me if I'd be willing to take over that position, which I was thrilled to be able to do.
How did your time, well, maybe forecasting at WDAY and trying to kind of prepare you and develop you for all this?
It really helped me in many ways understand weather instrumentation, because it all comes down to weather instrumentation. And the North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network, you know, we have now, I do believe, the largest weather network in the country is NDON, the North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network. Plus, we're working with the state of Minnesota and the Minnesota Department of Ag to spread the network throughout the entire, almost the entire state of Minnesota, with the exception of the core of the Twin Cities and Arrowhead of Minnesota, but the rest of the state, we're adding stations there. And so when you deal with forecasting, it's like you get to know the sensor because you want to be accurate. So you know that the airport in Fargo, for example, has some oddities and some biases. Well, you forecast for the biases because you want to have the same number in your forecast. But it's just really learning that. So then when you're jumping into a weather network, where so much of your job is weather instrumentation, making sure they're calibrated correctly, make sure they're giving out the correct data that we need for all the research and the tools that we offer, it really just led into that very, very much. And of course, when you're a broadcast meteorologist, you're the all-around scientist for everybody. And plus, you have to deal with a lot of climatology. And so in turn, that position made really in many ways a smooth transition for me to move into that role as well.
You've mentioned it two or three times, you've talked a little bit about it, but what is the North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network?
We are referenced as a mesonet, so meso network. Meso in Greek is middle, and so it's really the middle component of the atmosphere in the sense of mesoscale. So in meteorology, there's a mesoscale, there's a synoptic scale, there's a micro scale, different scales. So what we're trying to do is have a weather station approximately every 15 to 20 miles throughout the entire state of North Dakota, and then now also in Minnesota. And so this provides data. You know, of course, we're an agricultural weather network, so our focus is on agriculture. We generally can forecast, like, when is this insect going to emerge? You know, when is this disease going to form? It gives farmers that heads up that today, you know, if I spray today, I will get ahead of that disease or that insect. If you wait 3 or 4 days, then it might be too late, or you have to spray a little bit more. So there's a cost there in doing that. Or, hey, I don't have to spray. The disease threat is zero. So you get to save that spraying. So it's really an economic tool. It's a very strong value proposition for agriculture in the state. It's really hard to estimate how much knowing that actually saves, but the estimates could be $100 million a year just for the state of North Dakota. And so in turn, that value proposition, saving farmers money, increasing their profits, of course, then that goes on to the local town, spreads out. You know, every dollar, as we know, economically gets spread out multiple times. So it's really a large benefit for the state. But that's just agriculture. So, you know, we've worked with the Metro Flood Diversion Authority here in Fargo, put all season gauges so we can measure that liquid in the snow in the winter in multiple locations, so we know all winter long where are we going to be for precipitation. We've worked with the Red River Joint Water Resource District, the Devil's Lake Joint Water Resource Board, and other agencies in the Army Corps of Engineers to just bring this data in, so in turn we have such a much better understanding of what may possibly happen in the future. And again, all of these are a strong value proposition, which in turn is why I just love my job.
But you mentioned two or three different scales there. What's the difference of the scales, your measurement?
Well, think of synoptic scale as a weather map. If you watch the weather tonight on some local broadcasting company, you know, there'd be a map maybe with an area of low pressure, cold front, warm front. You know, that's more synoptic scale. It'd be like the Midwest. Mesoscale, again, depends on which definition you want to use, but a lot of times it's between that 40 and 60 mile range. Say, think a county is mesoscale. And then microscale is oftentimes, say, Fargo-Moorhead, and to some degree Bismarck, the larger cities, that urban heat island that you develop in a very small area, that would be more microscale.
Yeah. So what kind of weather pattern is North Dakota in right now?
Right now, most of this winter, we've been in what we would refer to as northwest flow. And northwest flow is the upper level wind. Generally, this winter is coming from the northwest. And if you think about it, what is to the northwest of North Dakota? The prairie provinces, the Rocky Mountains. There's not like a big ocean up there anyplace. And it tends to be our dry flow. So when we have our dry seasons or our dry decades, they're dominated by northwest flow. If the flow comes in from the southwest, say from California, Colorado, those storms, as they're creeping up towards us, can pull in moisture from the Gulf of Mexico, America, whatever you want to call it, that moisture streams up. That's where our big storms come in. So say the winters of 09, 10, 11 that were so extremely wet. we're under southwest flow almost those entire winters. And so those are the two dominant flow patterns that we get here in the northern plains. And one is wet and one is dry. And so that's why you'll go a couple, 3 years really, really wet. And sometimes you go 6, 7, 8 years where it's dry, you know, because, you know, it's always that constant reminder. Most people know this, but North Dakota, Minnesota, you know, the upper Midwest and northern plains here, we have one of the most dynamic, ever-changing climates of where anyone lives in the entire world. So it's never boring here for more than a day or two.
And so what do you foresee for this summer, spring and summer?
Well, I was just up in New Rockford speaking on this just last evening when this was being recorded, at least. And in turn, you know, it just this summer to me, there's a lot of things going on globally. And when you're forecasting that far in advance, what I do and a lot of other long-range forecasters, and it's not a lot of us, but you use analogs. And analogs is going looking in the past for similar conditions. For instance, there's a very weak La Nina in the Pacific Ocean right now. And that's the cooling of the equatorial Pacific waters. There's been eight of these events since 1980, weak La Ninas, okay? And when I look back at those, 6 of the 8 summers following that, most of North Dakota were dry, drier than average. Not necessarily like dry, super bad drought or anything, just drier than average. And so right there gives you a hint. And there's other things happening in the Pacific right now. And all of these things, most of the time, not always, because every year is unique, is they're a little bit drier. And so I go, you know, I go through it one by one. You know, there's 4 things here that all point towards most of the time when that happens, the summer ends up being a little drier than average. Last summer outside of the Devil's Lake Basin was drier than average. Western North Dakota, you know, had a very severe drought and are still extremely dry at this point. You know, we'll wait till spring and see if we can get some moisture out in that part of the state. So that's my ongoing forecast is I just think for most, because one thunderstorm will change this area. There's always, you know, a spot that's wetter or drier than other spots because of thunderstorms. But I think as a whole, it just looks a little dry to me at the moment. So that's what I've been forecasting. But I always tell people, it's the future. You know, you have to take it. You know, I have a pretty good track record with this. But again, Mother Nature will do what Mother Nature does.
So let's talk a little bit about maybe a controversial subject, climate change. Where do you come down on this topic or what do you think?
If you would have told me 35 years ago, when I started in the business, that weather would be so politicized, I probably would have rolled my eyes at you. That's not impossible. And when you talk climate change, there happens to be a crack in the table that we're sitting on. You go on the tightrope. If I say one thing or the other, this side thinks I'm a quack. And I try to be a scientist about it, but you know, a lot of what you hear just, you know, isn't necessarily true. It's the extreme stuff that, you know, let's bring that back a little bit. The world's not going to end in 5 years. How many times do you see a politician or someone saying, you know, we don't do something 5 years from now, this is going to happen. And it never happens. Humans have an impact on the climate. Most good research suggests that it's going to be fairly mild. But the reality is all we know is carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. It will attribute to some warming. No one knows exactly how much, and no one really knows what the impacts are. Those are the true statements in that statement. And all good scientists, good reputable scientists would agree with that comment. You know, some people go, no, Daryl, they said this, or no, Daryl, they said this. But that's, you know, really what it is. Why I love my job at Endon in particular is climate or weather resiliency. We're building for that. You know, we live in this climate. You know, Devil's Lake has gone dry in the last 1,200 years. Devil's Lake has overflowed into the Cheyenne naturally in the last 1,200 years. You know, these things happened in the past. What caused those? What happened to the great droughts of the 13, 1400s? If you look at proxy data, the weather had been more extreme in the past than it is right now. That's not to say that humans don't have an impact. I just have to say that there's a lot of noise then there, and that's why there's ongoing research and moving forward. But in turn, you know, the reality is here, people might not want to hear this, and I might get a nasty email or two about saying this, but CO2 levels are not going to drop. So would the best thing of action just be climate resiliency for now and plan? And that's, you know, why I enjoy my part of Endon and when we're doing that. So it's a very complex issue, far, far more complex than, say, a given news story or what most people think.
I'm sure you've observed Los Angeles fires, the horror that's out there. Can you talk about what the factors and causes were out there? Is it water supply, land mismanagement, or does just climate play a big role in this?
Well, they're a wet, dry climate there. They're a Mediterranean climate. Fires are natural and important into the environment. And in turn there, it's just land use management. You know, they weren't allowed to do trimming around their properties, manage the possibilities of fire. Can you imagine people in Fargo, Moorhead just planting highly flammable plants around your house on purpose? And then you get one arsonist. And look, oh, the horribleness that it happened. But again, that's a, you know, it is a natural component of that climate because those plant species need fire in many ways to do regeneration. Don't take away the fact that, you know, obviously I feel horrible. I mean, it's just tragic beyond words. But, you know, to blame climate change on that, to me, would be a little bit of a stretch. It was mismanagement, human-induced, arson that did it. And, you know, water supplies at the moment. It was just a bunch of things went wrong. No one does any of these things on purpose, you know, and it's just bad things sometimes just happen, and it's tragic.
Quick flip, I mean, what about hurricanes in Florida? Obviously, the wet and the water up there, they seem to be getting worse in the past decade?
The Atlantic Ocean, and that's what most Americans see, the Atlantic Ocean has gone through a phase of more hurricanes. There's reasons for it. One of that reasons is the Atlantic Ocean has a multi-decadal oscillation pattern. Right now, the Atlantic Ocean is in its warm phase when you tend to get more hurricanes. Globally, there's no trend to hurricanes in the last 50 years, zero trend. And if you want to really technically, the trend is down, but it's not down statistically significant. So that's what, you know, you always have to defend. You always hear this stuff, but hurricanes have always existed in the Atlantic for literally, there's proxy data that there's hurricanes in Kansas when Kansas was underneath the ocean, you know, multiple millions of years ago. So when you place that many people, if the 1940s happen again in Florida, you haven't seen anything yet and bad stuff happening. Because the 1940s had five very serious hurricanes go through when the population was probably less than a million people. Now I do believe they're somewhere in the teens, Florida, million. So when you put that much infrastructure in, and then everyone, look at the billion-dollar disasters. Well, there's more targets, you know, now. So that's one of those things, again, humans, you know, we should have a little bit more common sense on building and stuff.
What's the most common question asked of you, as it relates to weather and things from the public?
It really depends on the season. It really kind of goes through cycles. You know, lately, it's what's our frost depth? And I'll get that over and over again. Or, Daryl, you know, there's no snow in the ground. And, you know, and lately, it depends where they're calling from. Like, and I go, well, Fargo, for example, this so far this winter, we're ranked 36th least snowy winter. And people go, huh? Yeah, there's 35 winters with even less snow than this. And it's always to refresh their memories that you remember the snowy years because bad thing, you know, you had to work hard and it was a different winter. No one remembers the winters where there wasn't no snow. This is not as unusual as people make it out to be. So again, it really depends on the time of year, but trust me, the questions are always coming.
Well, I wish we had more time for questions and answers, but if people want more information, where can they go? Who can they contact?
You can contact me for any number of things, and I will take you. If I can't answer them, I will push you to somebody that I know. I'm pretty easy to find. I'm sure I was supered at some point during this lecture. And I'm at NDSU as a state climatologist. If you put North Dakota State Climatologist or something, you would find me. My phone number is on there for people, and my email. I will welcome all questions.
Yeah. Daryl, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here today.
That was Daryl Richardson, our state climatologist here in North Dakota, chatting with Prairie Pulse's John Harris about past, present, and future forecasts, plus a little climate change for good measure. You can watch the full conversation on our website. Just search for Prairie Pulse and Prairie Public. The show airs weekly on the television service of Prairie Public, come rain or shine. Thank you.
This is Bird Note. When Peter Hotham learned that few people were studying the tufted puffin in the Pacific Northwest, he began delving into what was known about the local puffin population.
And so when we realized that even with the minimal information available that the species was declining worryingly, we needed to almost start from the beginning.
Peter, who's a professor at the University of Puget Sound, says that while the biggest tufted puffin populations are further north in the Aleutian Islands of Alaska, it's important to study the smaller number that breed off the coast of Washington and Oregon. The challenges facing the species at the fringes of where they live could be the same ones that will affect the core population further north in the future.
They first start to show signs of decline on the periphery. It frequently signals a more fundamental problem affecting the species, and that first manifests itself on the peripheries where those populations have less of a buffer. They can't accommodate challenges as well because conditions aren't as favorable as they are in the core of their range. So we're seeing parallels to what we see in the Pacific Northwest here over in Japan and Russia, and even in parts of Alaska.
And picking up these kinds of early warning signals could help biologists plan for a better future for tufted puffins. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 10th. On the surface, Senate Bill 294 seemed straightforward. Its intent was to loosen the state's blue laws that restricted activities on Sundays. North Dakota had these laws in place since statehood. SB 294 aimed to allow bathing beaches, Chautauqua assemblies, pleasure resorts, boating, swimming, canoeing, and more on Sundays. The bill passed the Senate, but the House narrowly defeated it. Some believed it was worth another try, but before being reintroduced, supporters of Sunday activities quietly added a new provision. The second version of the bill passed both houses, and Governor Lynn Fraser signed it into law. On this date in 1917, the Fargo Forum and Daily Republican revealed details of the law that had passed the day before. The amendment, inserted by theater owners, allowed corporations, companies, or individuals to conduct meetings, assemblies, and audiences for educational or agricultural work and charge admission. Theater owners had long argued that if Chautauquas could operate on Sundays and show moving pictures, then theaters should be able to do as well. According to what the newspaper called a joker of an amendment, movie theaters were now allowed to open on Sundays. H.I. Hartman, president of the North Dakota Theater Association, explained that all theaters had to do was show films with agricultural or educational content on Sundays. He noted that news and travel movie weeklies, which various companies produced, counted as educational. Theaters could run these as the main feature and add other films to the program. Since the new law repealed all previous blue laws, theaters were now in compliance. The blue laws were loosened, but they didn't completely disappear. Shopping remained prohibited from midnight until noon on Sundays. That law wasn't repealed until 2019, when the legislature passed Blue Law House Bill 1097, and Governor Burgum signed it into law. As a result, big retailers like Menards and Target began opening on Sunday mornings, and Walmart became a 24/7 operation. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The American auto industry has been hit hard by the threat of tariffs. Stocks have been falling since President Donald Trump announced plans for tariffs on Mexico, China, and Canada. Tesla's stock has seen an even steeper decline than most car manufacturers. So what's driving Tesla's downturn? That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us. Tomorrow on Main Street, we'll visit with Tom Sawyer, the president and developer of Grand Sky. We'll discuss the impact and future of the nation's premier uncrewed aircraft systems flight operations center in Grand Forks as it celebrates its 10th anniversary. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.